another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hello, this is Jack Spearfield with another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and changing economic times and the things that we can do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, folks, today's first order of business is, as you know, I've been running a listener appreciation contest with a goal of reaching 1,000 listeners. When we hit 1,000 listeners, I'm going to be giving away a free iPod Nano. Excuse me. And everybody that's participated in the contest so far, I decided to go ahead, since we hit the halfway point and crossed 500 listeners earlier last week, to go ahead and give away 5 copies of a book that I co-authored called The Inner Salesman. I know it's really not about survivalism and per se, but it is about a lot about the human condition and human psychology and understanding how to barter and how to negotiate. I think those will be very important skills in a post-shit-hit-the-fan scenario that we may be in for at some point. So I do think they do fill that niche. So give me just a second. Let me grab this list, and I'm going to go ahead and read through it. So here we go. Here are the winners of the first round of prizes. I call these secondary prizes, which, again, is a copy of my book, The Inner Salesman, hand autographed by me. So far, 3 of these people have emailed me back and told me that that where they wanted the book shipped. So 2 of these folks need to get in touch with me and respond to my email. And if you didn't get an email from spam filtering or whatever, please go to the contact form and get in touch with me. Sean McCready, who did get in touch with me. Damian Maddox, who I do not believe I've heard from yet. Dan Tanner, who I also don't believe I've heard from yet. Levi Riley, who has emailed me back, and Simon Templar, who I believe has emailed me back. So Dan Tanner and Damian Maddox, you two folks, I know Dan particularly listens quite a bit. You guys need to get in touch with me and tell me where to ship these books to, or they're going to go to somebody else. On Monday, I'll do a new drawing, so you two guys need to get a hold of me. The other 3 will be shipping your books out to you over the weekend. Next thing I want to talk about briefly before we get into the subject of today's show is these hurricanes that are kind of lined up like planes waiting to come in and land at a major metropolitan airport. We've got Hannah that's going to hit the Carolinas, it looks like. And I think it's going to have some flooding and some real storm surge issues. It's supposed to make landfall right around high tide about 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's going to be rough, and I feel bad for those people, but I think they're pretty well prepared for the situation. They go through it quite often, and I think this storm maybe will be a Category 2 when it makes landfall. It's going to hit land further north than some of the more recent storms, and that means it's going to hit some cooler water. So hopefully it will downgrade itself a little bit by the time it actually makes landfall. I'm expecting it to increase in strength, and then sometime around Saturday morning, I think, hit the Carolinas. So you folks batten down up there. Move out if you're on the coast, but I think you're going to be all right. The next storm, though, I have really, really a bad vibe for. And since I have a bad vibe, I've got to tell you, if you're in the South Florida area, I think it is time for you to make some serious decisions right now about what you're going to do. This storm is a Category 4. It may end up ravaging Cuba and slipping by you, but I think the chances that it's going to really wreak havoc on South Florida are quite high, especially if you're in the Dade County, Miami, Homestead Air Force Base. We all remember what happened with Andrew. I think this storm has that potential, and I think you need to make a decision about whether you're going to hole up or get out. I think you need to have plans for each, and I think I would err to the side of caution here. If your plan is to evacuate, you may want to jump a few days in advance. Go get a nice hotel room somewhere up in the northern part of the state. Cruise on up to Jacksonville, where I used to live. Hang out for a couple days and move back in after it passes. If you're going to hole up because you want to protect what you have, make sure you have a safe zone, someplace that it should be safe from the damage, and really, really, you know, second-guess yourself at that. If where you live, there's flooding potential, and there's not many areas in Florida that don't have potential for flooding. It's a pretty flat place. I grew up a good part of my childhood in Florida before we moved to Pennsylvania. So I know how that can be. So, folks, please take this one seriously. The one behind it after Ike I think it's Josephine. Could be bad, too, but this Ike thing looks really nasty. Our thoughts are with you, all of us here. If you're in South Florida, we're going to hope that thing passes by you, and we hope it doesn't do too much damage to Cuba. If it does, then the other side of this thing is if Ike doesn't hit Florida and turn up the Florida coast into, like, the Panhandle area and what have you, which is one of the things it could do, then there's a real potential for it to get into the Gulf of Mexico, and there's only one way in and no way out when a hurricane comes into the Gulf. And that means somebody from, like, down by Mexico all the way up to Texas and Louisiana, now Alabama's going to deal with it there. So you guys all along that coastline be watching this one, too. Okay, that's the weather report, I guess, on the potential for shit hitting the fan anytime soon. I want to move into something completely different from that. I want to talk to you about the price of oil. And I want to do this a little bit differently than I've ever done it before. I want to take the approach here, like being a mechanic and you being a person who drives a car every day, one of the people that, honestly, I think you should know how your car works, but most people don't. They have no idea how their car works. They have no idea how anything in their car works. They just know they turn the key and it goes and they put gas in it, and maybe they're at least up to speed enough to know that every so often you take it in and you get it inspected, you get the oil changed and services and things like that. They give you a maintenance schedule, but they don't know how the engine works. They don't know how the electrical system works. They don't know anything. And because of that, when something's not quite right, they have no idea where in the vehicle's system it's not quite right. So I want to take the approach is you're that person with the car. I'm a mechanic, and you've come to me, and you have no desire whatsoever to know the internal workings of an internal combustion engine. But you've had a problem I fixed that I'm worried that it's going to come back in a different way and be a bigger problem. And then if it comes back and you don't recognize it, your car could blow up. So I'm going to explain to you how the basics of the system works so you'll know what to watch out for. In a car situation, you bring it back to your mechanic. In this situation, you just up your preparations. And you do whatever it is that you feel you need to do in your personal life to deal with continuing rising prices in oil. Because I'm about to kind of pull back the sheets here, and I'm going to let you understand things at a level, and I'm sure you've heard many of the things I'm going to tell you about, but I'm sure you've probably never heard them put together this way before, and odds are you haven't heard all of them. And you might, after I explain this to you, go, why the heck doesn't the news tell us some of this stuff? So let's just start out with the first thing. Oil's just dropped to $108 a barrel, and everybody's ringing bells and being happy about it, except for Wall Street, which still tumbled over $300 on the Dow Jones average yesterday due to poor sales reports and all. But maybe these guys that live and die by numbers, maybe they know a little bit more than we do, and maybe it's a little bit worse than just some poor retail numbers and some rising in the jobless claims. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that $108 a barrel oil is not a drop, okay? It's a drop from $140. I mean, I'll give you that. But the problem with $108 a barrel oil is that let's look at the last, 3 years before this year here and see if we've really dropped or if we're at really what would be considered an all-time high for the year. Looking back at last year, 2007, doesn't seem like that long ago. Around August of last year, which is a month before right now, right around the time we were hitting a high and coming down, we had also kind of hit a high through the year so far at $78 a barrel for West Texas crude. And September came, and the same kind of things, not the exact same kind of things, but many of the same types of things drove the price down around the $68 a barrel range. Now, that's only $10 a barrel, and we've seen a much bigger drop going from 140 to 108 here. Recently, but it was a pretty big percentage. If you think about 78 to 68, that's greater than 10%, probably 12, 13, 14%. It's a pretty big drop in 1 month. That's what happened last year. Then oil rebounded as we went into the colder months and people needed, fuel oil and whatnot to heat their home, and surged to right under $100 a barrel. We didn't cross $100 a barrel range until we moved into 2008. But we were sitting right, hovering right in the $98 range at the end of 2007. So where are we at with the price of oil? Well, we're right back just a little bit higher than we were in December of last year. We're going into the cold part of the year. Oil usage will probably go up. And, so we're not really down anywhere from a year ago. In fact, we're way higher than a year ago. We were at $68 in September last year. We're at $108. That means right now we're at $40 a barrel $40 a barrel over where we were last year at the same time. $40. All right? That's about 70% of what the price was a year ago. So has it really dropped? If you called up your financial advisor and he put you into his stock when it was at $78 and it had been up to $140 and came back down to $108, what would he tell you? He'd say, you're up. We didn't dump it at the spike, but come on, your portfolio is doing great. You had a 60-70% gain. What more do you want from me? This is a positive thing if you're in the game, but with the oil prices where we're paying at the pump, we haven't dropped at all. This is all a lie. Let's make it a little bit worse. Let's go back and say you were investing in 2005. Well, you would have bought the stock at $40 and it'd be sitting at $108. Not bad, huh? Here's some real numbers. 2006, oil started out at about $60 a barrel. People were screaming that the price of oil was too high. By the middle of 2006, this is 2006, I'm sorry, at $60 a barrel. And then by the middle of 2006, it hit $78 a barrel. By the end of 2006, we were right back down to 60. So 2006 was remarkably stable for oil prices, $60 to $78 in that range. And, averaged out at about $65-$70, which is not far off from what 2007 was. 2005, oil started at 40, ended at 60. So it made a big run, 40 to 60. That's a, 33% run up. And it ran straight up through the year in 2005, never faltered. So what we've seen is oil from 2005 to 2008 right now, go from $40 a barrel to $108 a barrel. So first of all, the drop that you're being told about is a lie. It has not been a drop. It has been a temporary reduction in a spike, but it's been a constant surge upward that began about 3 to 4 years ago. Now what we really need to look at here is what caused the spike. If we don't understand what caused the spike, we're not going to understand why we are where we are today. And why that spike is just a prelude to where we're going to go back to eventually, permanently, and continue to grow from. We'll never get that without understanding how the hell did we get there in the first place? What causes? Now, you heard a lot about the evil speculators, and they get some blame. But let's just look at reality overall. Look at the three big drivers that drove this huge spike through the summer of 2008. The first one is something that happens almost every year. Heavy summer season. In summer, people take vacations, they get on airplanes, they drive cars, they rent cars. A lot of times when people rent cars, they rent SUVs where they normally drive Toyota Priuses. It's just a busy time of year for travel. At summer season, you see gas prices, even when gas was a buck a gallon, remember it wasn't that long ago, go up 10, 20 cents when it was a buck a gallon. So we'd sit through most of the year at $1, $1.05. Right, summer come, we go up to about $1.18. Everybody rumble, rumble, grumble, 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 back down when the summer ends. So that happened again this year, just like everywhere else. And when the United States' oil usage goes up, it's massive on the world because we use about 25% of the world's oil. Some of those whacked out environmentalists that say we are kind of a parasite on the world, in a way, they're right. When we're sucking up 25% compared to the rest of the world, that's a pretty big chunk. It's nothing compared to what we do with our military, but it is a big chunk. And that just means that when we make an adjustment up or down, right, that it has a bigger effect than if the UK buys or uses less oil or France buys or uses less oil. I mean, they just don't really make a big mark in the global marketplace. Even though they're large industrialized nations, their usage in comparison to the whole is much smaller. So if we make a 1% up, or 1% down adjustment as a nation, then we have a bigger effect than if China, or I mean, I'm not China, like if the UK makes a 1% up or down adjustment. Hold on, China, they're going to get their blame here in just a second. Before we get to China, though, let's talk about these evil oil speculators, evil, evil guys, evil. These guys that sit back there with, calculators and spreadsheets, and they push a couple buttons and the price of oil goes up. They push a couple buttons and the price of oil goes down. And then they push a bunch of buttons and it goes way up to $140 a barrel. And they all party and make a bunch of money. And then they let it go back down and they make a bunch of money again. And they're evil and they are preying on us and they're stealing our money. Nonsense. nonsense. If there were a group of people sitting down on Wall Street that could force oil to $140 a barrel, it would be $140 a barrel still today. In fact, it would be $160 a barrel, because Exxon, Texaco, Shell Oil, Venezuelans, the Arabs, and the Mexicans, and the Canadians, and everybody would go see those guys and say, hey, keep doing it. Here's some more money. What do you need? Right? They like when oil goes up. Right? They would keep it up there as long as they could. Halliburton would you know, buy these guys free jets and give them to them with free fuel to keep the price at $140 a barrel. So I think what we need to understand is what the hell is a speculator? And what effect do they really have on the market? They do have some. Here's what a speculator is. A speculator, if they are any good, and if they stick around, and if they have any impact whatsoever, is a person or a company whose purpose is to monitor the market, in this case the commodities market, the oil market, and determine what the future holds. All right? And what they do is they don't manipulate the price. They purchase options based on where the price is going to go. There's two kinds of options. I don't want to get into really in-depth financial analysis here, but what most people don't understand is that you can buy an option on a stock in the form of an option to buy or sell. You can do it with commodities. Well, you can buy an option on contracts. In other words, I might buy an option to purchase oil at $120 a barrel. Okay? Option to purchase. When oil is at $115. Right, and what will happen is if oil happens to go up to 130, I can still exercise my option to buy at 120, and I make the spread. But the real money in options trading is trading the option itself. When the price of the commodity exceeds the price of the option to buy obviously increases in value. So you never actually exercise your option to buy the contract. You sell off the option to buy to somebody else. All right. There's also another kind of option. It's called a put. This is an option to sell. Reserve my option to sell. Now, why do these things exist in the first place? Why were they created? They were created as insurance policies. So let me explain this to you. If I were sitting on oil, I just bought a bunch of contracts on oil at $100 a barrel. $100 a barrel, make a nice even number. I might put in a put option. Give myself the option to sell oil at $95 a barrel. So and it would be very inexpensive for me to do that compared to my total investment. You know, pennies on the dollar for the option, right? This is an insurance policy. How does it work? All of a sudden something happens, oil drops through the floor, hits 78 bucks. I can still sell my oil for 95 to the holder who wrote me the put option. I might also buy a call option where I can buy oil at $105 a barrel. So if I have some reserve capital and all of a sudden oil spikes, then I can come in and buy at 105. I don't miss my low-end target to buy more if I'm going to be buying on the way up. That's how they were supposed to be used. Now what happens is people actually trade the option. All right. So all these speculators are doing are buying the option to purchase contracts really high or really low. And when the guys that really know what they're doing start buying a lot of contracts at a much higher price point, then the market looks at it and goes, oil's going to go up. So that does increase some demand. More and more people put money into the sector, and it does drive prices up. It does not have the effect that, you know, Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and all these jackasses on television make it out to be, the evil oil speculators. Remember what I tell you about class warfare, folks? All these congressmen dragging these guys up, you know, wagging their finger. How much money do you make, Mr. Oil Executive, saying it's the speculators. It's freaking nonsense. These people are playing a very dangerous game, and if they don't get it right, they lose their ass. That's the effect of speculation on the oil market. It's very small in comparison to all the other factors across the world. But what happened this year from China is something we've never seen before. Now, this is not George Bush's bullshit about China and India and demand, and there's a billion people here and a billion people there, and they're all moving in the middle class. That's real. That's not what drove a $140 price point. Here's what most people don't know, and you've got to understand this. Because if you don't understand this, you're not going to understand why we had the drop. And if you don't understand why we had the drop, you're not going to understand why it's a temporary situation. All right? Here's what happened. China had the Olympics this year. All right? That was their big deal. And they went all out with it. They were on stage for the world. China feels, I believe, that the Olympics in China were about China and Beijing, not about the athletes. They were put on their show for the world, including the 12-year-old gymnast, which I won't go into because it could eat up hours and hours of time. All right. When they were featured in front of the whole world, they didn't want to look back. They didn't want to be dishonored. All right? So there's two things they were concerned about. One, the pollution levels, the smog levels. So they spent 2 years cleaning up Beijing and the surrounding area in the bay. Used massive amounts of manual labor. But what most people don't know, and no one told you this, they mandated and pulled 50% of the cars in the Beijing area off the road. This is millions of vehicles parked. You're not allowed to drive. See, in China, the government can tell you, you know what, you don't need a car. You can't drive your car. You know what, we're going to pull some of this public transportation back. All you people, you can walk. See, in China, the government has that kind of power. That kind of totalitarian control still exists. Joe, no car for you for the next 6 months. Please, you know, all these people come and leave, and you can drive again. So that was one thing. Now, you'd say, well, Jack, if they pulled all these millions of cars off the road, they should have been using less fuel. So since they were using less fuel, the price should have went down, not up. Yeah, but again, it's important to understand how things work. The other side of this was that China was afraid that there would be fuel shortages for the journalists and the athletes and all these entourages and all these corporate sponsors and everything when they came over. So China went on a buying spree. At the same time they were cutting their usage of fuel, they were buying it at an astronomical growing rate. They bought the crap out of fuel. They put up huge, tremendous amounts of reserves so they wouldn't be disgraced by having one gas pump go empty during the 2008 Olympics. This is true. You can verify it. I found this information out from a guy named Ed Wallace that reviews cars, all right, and talks about the price of fuel all the time. No dog in the hunt politically, all right? Good guy, local journalist, guy I trust, you know. Guy tells you what kind, you know, you call him up and go, I'm thinking about buying car A and car B, helps you figure that out, right? This is not some right-wing whack job. This is not some left-wing whack job. This is a guy that pays attention to the motor economy. This is what he's involved with. That's what I learned from him. That makes perfect sense. That creates a potential storm here coming very, very soon. So that kind of just explains to you where the spike came from. Now, once we understand the spike, then we can understand this quote-unquote drop down to $108 a barrel. Okay, the first thing, remember what I told you, the United States uses 25% of the world's oil reserves, right? And that when we increase our busy summer season, that we put a big draw on the supply side, right? We exceed capacity really easily. We start pulling more than the input tube is allowed to deliver. Well, the one thing about the United States economy is we can only manipulate it so far. We have a lot of what we call expendable income in this country. And as soon as you start to, you know, push us, we start to spend less of it. So the U.S. consumer went out and bought more fuel-efficient cars. The U.S. Worker figured out how to telecommute one day a week. More and more people carpooled. People bought motorcycles. People bought mopeds. This happened all through the summer. And then the busy traffic dropped at the same time, and fuel usage in the United States dropped significantly. So we put a bubble in the supply side, because the supply side is constantly trying to be balanced with the demand side. It's the most precarious industry in the world to be in, because if you overproduce, you kill yourself. If you underproduce, you can't deliver. Right? It's a lot like running a network, you know, a computer network. Works the same way. Oil industry's tough, folks. I mean, these guys get a bad rap sometimes. They deserve it sometimes, but other times people don't understand how easy it is to lose your ass in oil. Right? When oil's at $20 a barrel, you screwed up and ramp capacity up too fast. That's why oil sat at $20 a barrel for a long time in the 90s, because they screwed up their own business. They produced too much too fast. And we burnt through it. And then we ran out. And the growth caught up with the capacity. So the first thing that caused this drop is just the U.S. consumer, one, coming out of that busy season, and two, just deciding, I'm paying too damn much, so I'm going to figure out ways to buy less. All right? That is a big deal. The other thing is, what people don't realize is when gas got really, really expensive, let's look at like Exxon. The reason Exxon has such a stranglehold on the industry is because, like other oil companies, Exxon explores for oil, drills the oil, moves the oil to the refinery, refines the oil, sells the oil from the refinery to the wholesaler, wholesales it to the retailer, right? The only thing they're not involved with is the money from the retail side, which they are because they have an Exxon gas station. So they control the oil from the drop coming out of the ground to the drop going into your gas tank. All right. Now, it's important for their financials for all of these sectors to make money. Refining has been losing money like crazy. All right. So, and the reason is that because the people are buying less gas, and refinery margins are very thin. So they needed to allow the price of gas to come down some, to up the demand side some, so they can move some of their profit into the refineries, to keep that piece of their machine going, because they, even though these are all controlled by Exxon, they're all run as independent business units, okay? So one is just Exxon, Shell, all these companies on their own, going ahead and jacking up supply enough, reducing the price enough so that they can move some of their profit from exploration, delivery, and retail back to the refineries to keep the refineries humming. So that was part of it. It's a small part, but it's definitely part. The next thing is, you know, China's surplus is about to really make a difference here, in a kind of a strange way. Right now, China's bringing all those cars back on the road, all right, that I told you about. All those cars, millions of cars they pulled off the road in Beijing to reduce their smog and congestion, they didn't really care about the problem, they cared about the image. All those cars are coming back and they're burning through those reserves. So even though they've had a momentary lapse in their demand, it is just going to increase. So right now we're seeing the drop side. That's what we're seeing right now. We'll talk about the increase in a second. I'm sorry, I kind of lost track. Their truck trying to run me off the road. But right now, because China's sitting on all that surplus, we're continuing to see this temporary lull in pricing. And then the other thing is the entire global marketplace has been in economic decline. So everybody's doing the same thing the United States is. They're burning less fuel. The airlines have figured out how to burn less fuel. They shove more people on the flights. They've gotten more efficient. Everybody everywhere, city governments, have gone to four-day work weeks. And that's happened all over the place, not just in the United States. So the economic decline itself helps correct the price of fuel, because when people have less money, they spend less money. When they spend less money on fuel, then the price of fuel has to come down, because again, these guys have to move that fuel. You can't just sit on it forever. It's got to be refined and moved to make a profit, and that's what these guys are in business for, is making a profit. So now that we understand the drop, let's look at the reasons why we're going to see it come back up. Number one is what I call price point psychology. Do you remember not that long ago, a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years, when $2 gas sounded ridiculous in the United States? $2 a gallon was like, that's insane. You would beg for $2 gas. You'd beg for $3 gas right now. $3.40 we're happy with. $3.30 we're overjoyed with. $3.60 we're even like, yeah, that's not that bad. Okay, so there's a certain reality here. You don't sell a product for less than you have to. And once you get the consumer to accept $100 a barrel, it's a psychology point, where $108 looks low, and $3 a gallon is a psychology point, you never let it come back. I said this when gas hit $2 a gallon years ago. We'll never see $1.80 again. Never going to happen, because now the consumer has accepted $2 as a reasonable price point. They've now pushed the reasonable price point to $3 a gallon. So we're going to see a strong support to keep oil up around the $100 a barrel point. You might see it hit $96 a barrel or $97 a barrel. That'll bring gas down at $310, $315, right? People will party. People will go buy a new SUV. And the whole cycle will begin to ramp back up again. So the psychology of the price point is going to keep it supported at a certain level. And then when people think it's a good number, they're going to start over-consuming again. So that's one of the things that's going to drive it back up. The other thing is, you know that profit movement that I talked about? Well, once the refineries start to show a good profit again, guess what? You can ramp up refinery production again and let their profits wane some. All right? So then you can push a big surplus of fuel into the market, drive the price down. And people keep saying, well, why is driving the price down bad? Because as soon as you drive the price down with the psychology of three's okay now, and people start consuming again at high volume, that's eventually going to drive a price up, okay? That's another aspect that we're going to deal with here. The next thing we're going to deal with is, well, winter's coming, folks. Just like the story of the grasshopper and the ant from yesterday. And it's not a metaphor this time. Winter is coming, and with winter, some cold-ass weather. And we're expecting to have a more severe winter this year, again, despite all Al Gore and the global warming theorists. It's going to be a pretty tough winter is what it's looking like. If Farmer's Almanac says so, it's usually pretty dead on. And we're going to see high fuel oil usage in the northeast and the north-central United States, as we always do. That's going to increase demand on oil. So that is coming toward the end of the year. Don't look for oil to finish at $100 a barrel this year. Look for oil to do the same type of thing that it's done the last few years. And on a big tick up, $120, $130 a barrel, something like that. And people will still say, well, it's down from $144. What do you want? All right? And then the other thing, this is the big one. This is the one nobody's talking about. China goes back to doing business as usual. China says, okay, all you Americans have left now, all you French people have left, the world's cameras are off of Beijing, bring those 500,000 vehicles back onto the road, fire them up, they'll burn through that surplus, and while they're burning through the surplus, they're not going to buy more, all right? They're not going to buy any, but they're not going to buy the way they were buying, but everybody in China is going to get used to all that gas, and it's going to start to come down and peter out, and when it does, they're going to have to resume their purchasing. And when that happens, buddy, let me tell you what, you're pulling the cap off of it. So those are some just basic market reasons. There's one more thing that we always seem to forget about when we talk about the price of oil. That's the place that you pull it out of the ground from, these oil fields. And are some of them beginning to decline in production? And you can bet that they are. I'm going to tell you something now that many Americans don't know. We always hear people, you know, mine, grumble, gripe, whatever you want to call it, about buying oil from the Arabs, all right? And we do buy a lot of oil from the Middle East. But the top three countries we import oil from, only one is Arabic, and that is Saudi Arabia. That's our number one supplier of imported oil right now, is Saudi Arabia. Number two, Canada, okay? Canada. Number three, Mexico. Mexico's got production problems, folks, and what you have to really understand here is, again, it's small little pieces of capacity reduction that have massive impacts on the total volume of oil. In other words, to have oil go way, way up, we don't need to run out of oil. All we have to do is have a 1% shortfall versus capacity and demand. When there's 1% of people trying to get oil or trying to get gasoline that can't find it because stations are out, gas goes through the roof. All right, that's just how this system works, because it's meant to work at peak efficiency. That's how the entire oil industry is built. It's meant to work all out, all the time, full tilt, full bore. So how is this going to be affected? What's going on right now? I'm going to give you one oil field as an example. There's more than one that are doing this, but this is a big one. And this is one that nobody's talking about. There's an oil field called the Cantrell oil fields down in Mexico. They're currently running low. How low? Well, they're running low enough that based on just our imports from Mexico, we are now getting 1.2 million barrels less a day from Mexico just due to the decline in this oil field. That's how massive this oil field has been. To put that in perspective for you, a little hiccup in price we have, our price bounced up for a little bit, it's coming back down right away from Hurricane Gustav. Hurricane Gustav didn't damage any of the oil platforms, but it reduced, it shut them down for a few days. So the guys had to get out of there so they didn't get hit by the storm, right? Okay, it cut us off 1.2 billion barrels a day. But it was temporary. This decline in the Cantrell fields is permanent. Those 1.2 million barrels are never, ever coming back, ever. Capacity has gone down, and it will not recover in that field anyway, okay? Now, when you look at that, you have to say, well, what does this mean as a whole? Let's look at this. Mexico is the sixth largest oil-producing country in the world, number six in the world. Most people just don't know that about Mexico. And Cantrell produces 60% of Mexico's oil. Say it again. Number six oil-producing country in the world, One oil field produces 60% of their oil. Its production capacity has dropped by 1.2 million barrels a day and is in continuing decline, and it will continue to go down every day from this point forward, and the oil will never come back. They've reached the end of the massive peak production capacity of the Cantrell field. It is gone. And there are other oil fields experiencing the same thing all around the world. But what it means for Mexico is bad because 40% of their real economy, and when I say real economy, I'm saying money that illegal aliens in the United States don't send back to Mexico, 40% of the Mexican economy is oil. And they're having their biggest oil reserve that produces 60% of that economy for them go into a permanent spiral downward decline. You think we have a lot of people coming across the Rio Grande River right now, folks. What happens when that growing middle class in Mexico starts to see the ceiling hit and starts to see decline? All right, so that's like another unintended consequence of peak oil. So these are the things that are going on right now. And there's these other oil fields across the world. There's giant oil fields in Saudi Arabia that are moving into the same cycle. I just bring up Cantrell because it's the latest thing. It's something you think you would hear about. You would think that Dan Rather or David Brinkley or whoever the hell these idiots are now, I don't even pay attention to them anymore. These guys could be retired. But you would think that they would tell you about things like this. They would tell you that Cantrell's running dry, that the place we get, you know, the third largest importer that we have has its biggest oil field running dry. You'd think they would tell you that, but they don't tell you that. Right? You think they would explain to you that the reason that oil went up is just because there's a billion people in China and India using it, but that China bought an ass load of oil leading up to the Olympics and created a surplus. You think they would explain to you that the drop is because they quit buying it because they pulled cars off the road, but they don't tell you any of these things. So I hope today's podcast has been enlightening. I hope it's opened your eyes to some of the ways these things work. I hope it's made you less susceptible to these jackasses manipulating you with bullshit like, oh, it's the speculators, it's the speculators. Again, speculators, they're just buying options to buy and sell oil. That's all they're doing. If they buy the option to buy at 130 and oil drops to 110, they lose their ass. All right? They're betting on horses. The people that bet on the horses don't affect where the horses finish in the race. That's really what the speculators do. They have a little bit of input, and they have an input of where other people bet. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, the horses run the race, and the first horse across the line is the first horse across the line, and the last horse across the line is the last horse across the line. If you bet on the wrong horse, you lose. All right? That's the speculator business in a nutshell. So, again, I just want you to stay aware of things. I don't want you to be lied to and think that oil's down. It's not. It's up. It's up over the past 3 years, and it's continuing to go up. I don't want you to believe that the problem's gone away. And I don't want you to decide that, hey, it's time to go buy another SUV. I want you to continue to prepare to live a better life if times get tougher, even if they don't. And that's what we're here for. Again, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast.
And you can holler. It really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.